uselessly, as if trying to wring it dry, then made a little hammock of the material in which to sling the crystal ball. Would my wet hands leave fingerprints? Who knew? It was the best I could do. "Blast it all," I said loudly, more for effect than anything, but signalling that I thought I was alone. With my peripheral vision, I could see that there was a swatch of colour among the bushes. By shifting my gaze slightly, I could see that it appeared to be a scarf. A flowered scarf. Could it be one of the pixies Daffy and Feely had told me about? One of those malevolent water sprites that stole babies? Perhaps it was the very one that had taken Mrs. Ball's child. But no, pixies didn't exist. Or did they? I let my eyes drift slowly to the right. Quite abruptly, as if by magic, an image snapped into place. It was like one of those optical illusions in the Girl's Own Annual, in which a silhouette of two faces in profile is suddenly seen to be an egg cup. Grey hair, grey eyes, staring straight at me, a scarf at the throat, riding breeches, even the monocle hanging by a black cord round the neck. It was Vernetta Harewood's companion, Ursula, standing motionless among the bushes, counting on the camouflage of stillness to keep me from spotting her. Ursula, who gathered willow withies from the river bank to twist into her dreadful baskets. I let my eyes meet hers, then drift away, as if I hadn't seen her. I looked to her right, to her left, and finally above her, letting my mouth fall open slackly. I scratched my head, and then, I'm afraid, my bottom. "I'm coming, Gladys!" I shouted. "It's only a squirrel!" And with that, I made off across the bridge, muttering away to myself like the mad daughter of an eccentric squire. "Damn!" I thought. "I hadn't had a chance to examine the police diggings!" Still, my day had been remarkably productive. In my pocket was the silver Deluce lobster pick that I was quite sure had been used to put an end to Brookie Harewood, and cradled in my skirt, the crystal ball that was almost certainly the object with which Fenella had been bashed. After all, if it wasn't, then why would it have been tossed into the river? An idea began to take shape. Of course I would hand over these weapons at once to Inspector Hewitt. I had planned to do so all along, for various reasons. But first, I wondered, was it possible to retrieve fingerprints from an object that had been immersed for days in running water? Chapter 23. I had climbed no more than a dozen stairs when Father's voice, from somewhere below me in the foyer, said,
"Flavia!"
Thwarted. I stopped, turned, and came down one step out of respect. He was standing at the entrance to the west wing.
"My study, please."
He turned and was gone. I trudged down the steps and trailed along behind him, making a point of hanging well back.
"Close the door," he said,
and sat down at his desk. This was serious. Father usually delivered his little lectures while standing at the window, gazing out into the grounds. I perched on the edge of a chair and tried to look attentive.
"I've had a call from Nurse Hammond on the..."
He pointed in the general direction of the telephone, but could not bring himself to say the word.
"Instrument. She tells me that you took Dr. Kissing out into the rain."
"The hag! I done no such thing!" "He wasn't in the rain," I protested. "He was sitting under an umbrella on the lawn, and he was already outside when I got there."
"It makes no difference," Father said, holding up a hand like a policeman directing traffic.
"But..."
"He's an old man, Flavia. He's not to be bothered with nonsensical intrusions upon his privacy."
"But..."
"This gadding about the countryside must stop," he said. "You're making a confounded nuisance of yourself."
"A nuisance? Well, I could have spat on his carpet."
"I've given this a great deal of thought recently," he said, "and come to the conclusion that you have far too much time on your hands.
But
part of that is my own fault, I'll admit. You've not been provided with sufficient supervision, and, as a result, your interests have become rather unhealthy.
Unhealthy?
Consequently, Father ploughed on, I've decided that you need to be more among people, more in the company of your peers.
What was he talking about? On the one hand, I was wandering about the village excessively, and now, on the other, I was in need of human companionship. It sounded like something you might say about a rogue sheepdog.
But before I could protest, Father took off his glasses, very deliberately folded their black, spidery arms across the lenses, and put them away in their hard-shelled case. It was a sign that the conversation was nearing its end.
The vicar tells me that the choir is in need of several extra voices, and I've assured him that you'd be happy to pitch in. They've laid on an extra practice this evening at 6:30 sharp.
I was so astonished, I couldn't think of a single word to say.
Later, I thought of one.
Don't dawdle,
Feely said, as we marched across the fields towards the church. She had been summoned to sit in, as she sometimes did, for Mr. Collicutt.
"Where's old Cocky, then?"
I had asked, and waited for the inevitable explosion. Feely, I think, was half in love with the handsome young man who had recently been appointed organist at St. Tancred's. She had even gone so far as to join the choir because of the superior view of his bobbing blonde curls afforded by a seat in the chancel. But Feely wasn't biting. In fact, she was strangely subdued.
"He's adjudicating the music festival in Hindley," she said,
almost as if I had asked a civil question.
"Do, re, mi, fa, so, what?"
I sang loudly and intentionally off-key.
"Save it for the sinners," Feely said pleasantly, and walked on in silence.
Half a dozen boys in scout uniforms, all members of St. Tancred's choir, were shoving one another about in the churchyard, playing a rough game of football with someone's hat. One of them was Colin Prout. Feely stuck her fist and last fingers into her mouth and let out a surprisingly piercing and unladylike whistle. The game broke up at once.
"Inside," Feely ordered, "hymns before horseplay."
Since its scoutmaster and several of the boys were also members of the choir, the scout troop would not meet until after choir practice. There were a couple of anonymous groans and whispers, but the boys obeyed her. Colin tried to scuttle past, his eyes fixed firmly on the ground.
"Hoi, Colin,"
I said, stepping in front of him to block his way. "I didn't know you were a scout." He put his head down, jammed his hands into the pockets of his shorts, and sidestepped me. I followed him into the church. The older members of the choir had already taken their places, chatting away to one another as they awaited the arrival of the organist, the men on one side of the chancel, the women facing them on the other. Miss Cool, who was both Bishop Lacey's postmistress and its confectioner, shot me a beaming smile, and the Misses Puddock, Lavinia and Aurelia, who own the St. Nicholas Tea Room, gave me identical twiddles of their fingers.
"Good evening, choir," Feely said.
It was a tradition that dated back into the mists of Christian history.
"Good evening, Mr. Luce,"
they responded automatically. Feely took her seat on the organ bench, and with no more than a hymn number 383 barked out over her shoulder, launched into the opening bars of We Plough the Fields and Gather, leaving me scrambling to find the page in the hymn book.
"We plough the fields and scatter,"
we sang,
"the good seed on the land, but it is fed and watered by God's almighty hand. He sends the snow in winter, the warmth to swell the grain, the breezes and the sunshine, and soft refreshing rain."
As I sang, I thought of Brookie's body dangling from Poseidon's trident in the downpour. There had been nothing soft or refreshing about that particular storm. In fact, it had been one hell of a cloudburst. I looked across the chancel at Colin.
He was singing with intense concentration, his eyes closed, his face upturned to the day's last light, which was now seeping in through the darkening stained-glass windows. I'd deal with him later.
He only is the maker of all things near and far. He paints the wayside flower, he lights the evening star. The winds and waves obey him.
The organ screeched to a halt in the middle of a note, as if someone had strangled it.
Deluce, a voice was saying sourly, and I became aware that it was Feely's.
She was addressing me. The voice cannot emerge through a closed mouth. Heads turned towards me, and there were a couple of smiles and titters. Now then, again, from The Winds and Waves Obey Him. She struck a leading note on the keyboard, and then the organ roared back to life, and we were off again. How dare she single me out in that manner? The witch! Just you wait, Ophelia Gertrude Deluce! Just you bloody well wait! To me, the choir practice seemed to go on forever, perhaps because there's no joy in simply mouthing the words. In fact, it's surprisingly hard work. But at last it was over. Feely was gathering up her music and having a jolly old chinwag with Cynthia Richardson, the vicar's wife, whose fan club did not count me among its members. I'd take the opportunity to slip away unnoticed and tackle Colin in the churchyard with a couple of interesting questions that had come to mind.
Flavia?
Drat! Feely had broken off a conversation and was bearing down upon me. It was too late to pretend I hadn't heard her. She seized my elbow and gave it a furtive shake.
Don't go sneaking off, she said in an undertone, using her other hand to wave a cheery goodbye to Cynthia. Father will be here in a few minutes, and he has asked in particular that you wait.
Father? Here? Whatever for?
Oh, come off it, Flavia. You know as well as I do. It's cinema night, and Father was quite right. He said you'd try to dodge it.
She was correct on both counts. Although I had since put it out of my mind, Father had announced suddenly several weeks earlier that we didn't get out enough as a family, a situation that he intended to rectify by subscribing to the vicar's proposed cinema series in the parish hall. And sure enough, here was Father now with Daffy at the church door, shaking hands with the vicar. It was too late to escape.
Ah, Flavia, the vicar said, thank you for adding your voice to our little choir of angels, as it were. I was just telling your father how pleased I was to see Ophelia on the organ bench. She plays so well, don't you think? It's a treat to see her conducting the choir with such verve, and a little child shall lead them, as the prophet Isaiah tells us. Not, of course, that Ophelia's a little child. Oh, dear me, no, far from it. But come away, the Bijou Cinema awaits. As we strolled through the churchyard towards the parish hall, I noticed Colin flitting from gravestone to gravestone, engaged, apparently, in some elaborate game of his own invention.
"I worry about that boy," I heard the vicar confiding to Father.
"He has no parents, and now, with Brookie Harewood no longer around, as it were, to look out for him. But I'm chattering. Ah, here we are. Shall we go in?"
Inside, the parish hall was already uncomfortably warm. In preparation for the pictures, the blackout curtains had been drawn against the evening light, and the place was already filling with that humid fug that is generated by too many overheated bodies in a confined space. I could distinguish quite clearly the many odours of Bishop's Lacey, among them the various scents and shaving lotions, of talcum powder, the vicar, of bergamot scent, the Mrs. Paddock, of rubbing alcohol, our neighbour, Maximilian Brock, of boiled cabbage, Mrs. Delaney, of Guinness stout, Mr. Danby, and of Dutch pipe tobacco, George Carew, the village carpenter. Since Miss Mountjoy, with her pervading odour of cod liver oil, was nowhere in sight, I circulated slowly round the hall, sniffing unobtrusively for the slightest whiff of fish.
"Oh, hello, Mr. Sperling. It's nice to see you." Sniff. "How's Mrs. Sperling getting on with her crocheting?"
"Gosh, it's such a lot of work, isn't it? I don't know where she finds the time."
In the centre of the room, Mr. Mitchell, the proprietor of the photographer's shop in the High Street, was grappling with writhing snakes of black cinefilm, trying to feed them into the maw of a projector. I couldn't help but reflect that the last time I'd been in the parish hall, it had been on the occasion of Rupert Pawson's final puppet performance, on this same stage of Jack and the Beanstalk. "Poor Rupert," I thought, and a delicious little shudder shook my shoulders.
But this was no time for pleasantries. I had to keep my nose to the grindstone, so to speak.
I rejoined Father, Daffy and Feely just as the front row of house lights was being switched off. I will not bother quoting the vicar's preliminary remarks about the growing importance of film in the education of our young people, and so forth. He did not mention either Brookie's death or the attack upon Fenella, although this was perhaps neither the proper time or place to do so. We were then plunged into a brief darkness, and a few moments later the first film flashed onto the screen. A black-and-white animated cartoon in which a chorus of horribly grinning cats in bowler hats bobbed up and down in unison, yowling, "Ain't we got fun?" to the music of a tinny jazz band. Mercifully, it did not last long. In the brief pause, during which the lights came up and the film was changed, I noticed that Mrs. Ball had arrived with Timothy and her toddler. If she saw me among the audience, she did not let on. The next film, Saskatchewan, Breadbasket of the World, was a documentary that showed great harvesting machines creeping across the flat face of the Canadian prairies, then rivers of grain being poured into railway hopper cars and the open hatches of waiting cargo ships. At the end of it, I craned my neck for a glimpse of Colin Prout. Yes, there he was at the very back of the hall, returning my gaze steadily. I gave him a little wave, but he made no response. The third film, The Maintenance of Aero Engines, Part 3, must have been something left over from the war. A film that was being shown simply because it happened to be in the same box as the others. In the light reflected from the screen, I caught Father and Feely exchanging puzzled glances before settling down to look as if they were finding it terrifically instructive. The final feature on the programme was a documentary called The Versatile Lemon, which, aside from the narrator's mentioning that lemons had once been used as an antidote to a multitude of poisons, was a crashing bore. I watched it with my eyes shut. The new moon was no more than a sliver of silver in the sky as we made our way homeward across the fields. Father, Daffy and Feely had got slightly ahead, and I trudged along behind them, immersed in my own thoughts. "Don't dawdle, Flavia," Feely said, in a patient, half-amused voice that drove me crazy. "She was putting it on for Father." "Squid!" I said, warping the word into a sneeze. Chapter 24. My sleep was torn by images of silver. A silver horse in a silver glade chewed silver grass with silver teeth. A silver man in the moon shone in the sky above a silver caravan. Silver coins formed a cross in a corpse's hand. A silver river glided. When I awoke, my thoughts flew back at once to Fenella. Was she still alive? Had she regained consciousness? Porcelain claimed she had, and the vicar said she hadn't. Well, there was only one way to find out. "Sorry, old girl," I said to Gladys in the grey dishwater light of the early morning, "but I have to leave you at home." I could see that she was disappointed, even though she managed to put on a brave face. "I need you to stay here as a decoy," I whispered. "When they see you leaning against the greenhouse, they'll think I'm still in bed."
Gladys brightened considerably at the thought of a conspiracy.
If I look sharp, I can hair it cross-country and catch the first bus for Hindley, this side of Oakshott Hill.
At the corner of the garden, I turned and mouthed the words,
"Don't do anything I wouldn't do,"
and Gladys signalled that she wouldn't. I was off like a shot. Mist hung in the fields as I flew across the ploughed furrows, bounding gracefully from clod to clod. By catching the bus on a country road, I wouldn't be seen by anyone except those passengers who were already on board. None of them would pose much risk of reporting me to Father, since they were all heading for destinations away from Bishop's Lacey. Just as I climbed over the last fence, the Coatsmore bus hove into view, clattering and flapping its wings like a large, dishevelled bird as it came jolting towards me along the lane. It stopped with a rusty sigh, and a tendril of steam drifted up from its nickel radiator cap.
"Board," said Ernie, the driver. Step up, mind your feet."
I handed him my fare and slipped into a seat 3 rows from the front. As I had suspected, there were few other riders at this time of day. A pair of elderly women who huddled together at the rear, too much in the grip of their own gossip to pay me the slightest bit of attention, and a farm worker in overalls with a hoe who stared sadly out of the window at the darkly misty fields. Sunrise would not be for another quarter of an hour. The hospital at Hindley stood at the end of a steep street that rose up precariously from behind the market square, its windows staring down glumly onto the black cobbles, which were still wet from the night's rain. Behind the high wrought iron gate, a porter's lodge bore a sign written in no-nonsense letters, "All visitors please report."
"Don't loiter," something told me, and I took its advice.
To the left, an archway of stained stone led to a narrow passage in which a couple of square gas lamps flickered with a sickly light.
"Hearses only," it said on a discreet plaque, and I knew I was on the right track.
In spite of my trying to walk in silence, my footsteps echoed from the wet cobbles and the seeping brick walls. At its far end, I could see that the passage opened into a small courtyard. I paused to listen. Nothing but the sound of my own breathing. I peered cautiously round the corner.
"Beck," said a loud voice, almost at my ear.
I shrank back and flattened myself against the wall.
"Beck, get yourself out here. Quenchy's man will be along directly, and we want to have her ready to hand over.
You know as well as I do what happens when we keep them waiting."
Ellis and Quench, I knew, was Hindley's largest and oldest undertaking firm, and was known far and wide for the shininess of its Rolls-Royce hearses and the gleam of its Daimler mourners' cars.
"When Ellis and Quench buries you, you're buried," Mrs. Mullet had once told me.
I could easily believe that they would not like to be kept waiting.
"Old matron gets her knickers in a knot," the voice went on. "If we're not all shipshape and Bristol fashion on the loading dock, and when old matron's not happy, I'm not happy. And when I'm not happy, you're not happy. Beck, get yourself out here, will you?"
There came the sound of boots shuffling on the timbers of the dock, and then a voice, a surprisingly young voice, perhaps a boy's voice, said,
"Sorry, Mr. Martin, I forgot to tell you. They rang up about 20 minutes ago. Said they'd be round later. Had a call out to the old infirmary, they did."
"Oh, they did they? The buggers. Think nothing of leaving the likes of us twisting in the wind, whilst they go larking about the countryside in their bloody Bentleys. Well, I'm going down to the boiler room for a cup of tea,
Quench or no Quench. Matron's up on Anson Ward with the latest crop of nursing sisters. Poor wee things. I hope they remembered their asbestos uniforms."
I waited until I heard the heavy doors close, then quickly, before I could think better of it, scrambled up onto the loading dock.
"Blast," I said under my breath, as a sliver of wood pierced my knee.
I pulled the thing out and shoved it into my pocket, so as not to leave any evidence behind. I dabbed at the oozing blood a bit with my handkerchief, but but there was no time for compresses. It would have to do.
I took a breath, pulled open the heavy door, and stepped into a dimly lighted corridor. The floors were marble, and the walls were painted, brown for the first 4 feet, then a ghastly green from there all the way up to the ceiling, which appeared to have been whitewashed in another century. On my right were three small cubicles, one of which was occupied by a wheeled cart, upon which lay a sheeted figure. It took no great stretch of the imagination to guess what lay beneath. This was the real thing, the genuine article. I was dying to undo the buckles on the straps and have a peek under the sheet, but there wasn't time. Besides, there was part of me that didn't want to know if the body was Finella's. Not just yet. Not in that way. From where I stood, I could see the full length of the corridor, which stretched away from me into the distance. It seemed endless. I began to move slowly, putting one foot in front of another. Right foot, left foot. On one side of the corridor was a double door marked laundry. From behind it came the muffled rumble of machinery and a woman laughing. Left foot, right foot, toe to heel. The next door was the kitchen, dishes clattering, voices chattering, and the powerful, clinging smell of greasy cabbage soup. Soup for breakfast? I realized that I hadn't eaten since yesterday, and my stomach gave a heave. For the next dozen paces, the walls were inexplicably moss-green, and then, just as quickly, a queasy mustard yellow. Whoever had chosen the paint, I decided, wanted to ensure that anyone who wasn't sick when they entered the hospital jolly well would be before they left. The next set of doors on the left, judging by the bracing whiff of formalin, belonged to the morgue. I gave a little shiver as I passed, not one of fear, but rather of delight. Another room was marked X-ray, and beyond that point, open doors on both sides of the corridor, with room numbers on every one. In each room, someone was sleeping or rolling over. Someone was snoring. Someone moaned. And I thought I heard the sound of a woman crying. These are the wards, I thought, and there must be others on the first and second floors. But how could I find Finella? Until then, I hadn't given it a moment's thought. How does one quickly find a needle in a haystack? Certainly not by examining one straw at a time. I had now arrived at a doorway that opened into a sort of large foyer, in the centre of which a woman wrapped in a black woolen sweater was staring intently at a spread of playing cards on her desk. She did not hear me come up beside her. "Excuse me," I said, "but you can put the five of diamonds on the black six." The woman nearly fell out of her chair. She jumped to her feet and spun round to face me. "Don't ever!" she said, her face going the colour of beets. "Don't you ever dare!" Her fist clenched and unclenched spasmodically. "I'm sorry if I startled you," I said. "I didn't mean to, really." "What are you doing here?" she demanded. "No visiting until 1:30 this afternoon, and it's only just gone..." She shot a glance at her watch, an impossibly tiny lump strapped to her wrist. "I'm waiting for my cousin," I explained. "She's just slipped in to bring our grandmother some..." I took a deep breath and racked my brains for inspiration, but the only thing that came to mind, to my nostrils actually, was the nauseating odour still leaking from the kitchen down the corridor. "Soup," I said. "We've brought our gram some soup." "Soup?" The woman's voice and her eyebrows went up into an inverted V. "You've brought soup. Here, to a hospital." I nodded meekly. "Who's your grandmother?" she demanded. "What's her name? Is she a patient here?"
"Finella Farr," I said without hesitation.
"Farr?
The gypsy woman?" she asked, sucking in her breath. I nodded dumbly.
"And your cousin, you say, has brought her soup?"
"Yes," I said, pointing haphazardly. "She went that way."
"What's your name?" the woman asked, snatching up a typewritten list from her desk.
"Flavia," I said. "Flavia Farr."
It was just implausible enough to be true.
With a snort like a racehorse, the woman was off, down a wide corridor on the far side of the foyer. I followed in her wake, but I don't think she noticed. Still, I kept well back, hoping she didn't turn round. I was in luck. Without a backwards glance, she vanished into the second room but one on the left, and I heard the sound of curtains being swept open. I didn't stop, but continued on past the open door. A single glance revealed Fenella in the farthest bed, her head swathed in bandages. I ducked down out of sight behind a draped cart that was parked against the wall.
"All right, come out of there," I heard the woman say, followed by the click of a door being opened. Probably the room's WC.
There was a silence, then a low, muttered conversation. Was she talking to Fenella, or to herself? The only word that came clearly to my ears was soup. Another brief silence, and then the sound of the woman's shoes went echoing away down the corridor. I counted to three, then flitted like a bat into Fenella's room, closing the door behind me. A whiff of ether told me that this must be the surgical ward. Fenella was lying motionless on her back, her eyes closed. So frail she looked, as if the bedsheets had absorbed the last ounce of her juices.
"Hello," I whispered. "It's me, Flavia."
There was no response. I reached out and took her hand. Ever so slowly, her eyes came open, fighting to focus.
"It's me, Flavia," I said again. "Remember?"
Her wrinkled lips pursed and the tip of her tongue appeared. It looked like the head of a turtle emerging from its shell after a long winter at the bottom of the pond.
"The liar," she whispered,
and I grinned as stupidly as if I had just been awarded first prize at the spring flower show. Licking her lips feebly, Fenella turned her head towards me, her black eyes now suddenly fierce and imploring in their sunken sockets.
"Threat,"
she said quite distinctly, giving my hand a squeeze.
"Sorry," I said, "I don't understand."
"Threat," she said again.
"Puff."
A light went on at the back of my brain.
"Cigarette?" I asked. "Is that what you're saying?"
She nodded.
"Threat. Puff."
"I'm sorry," I said. "I don't smoke." Her eyes were fixed upon mine, imploring.
"Tell you what," I said. "I'll go find you one. But first, I need to ask you a couple of important questions." I didn't give her time to think. "The first is this. Do you really believe I did this to you? I'd die if you did."
Her brows knitted.
"Did this?
Put you here, in the hospital. Please, Fenella, I need to know." I hadn't meant to call her by her given name. It just slipped out. It was that kind of moment. Daffy had once told me that knowing and using someone's name gave you power over them. There was no doubt that, at least for now, I had power over this poor injured creature, even if it was only the power to withhold a cigarette.
"Please, Fenella,"
I pleaded. If this was power, I wanted no part of it. It felt dreadful. Without taking her eyes from mine, she moved her head slowly from side to side.
"No,"
she whispered at last, replying to my question.
"No."
It was not the answer I was expecting. If Fenella didn't think I had attacked her, then Porcelain had lied.
"Who was it then?"
I demanded in a voice so rough that it surprised even me. Had that savage snarl issued from my throat?
"Who was it? Tell me who did this to you."
For some inexplicable reason, I wanted to seize her and shake the answer out of her. This was a kind of anger I had never known before. Fenella was terrified. I could see it in her fuddled eyes.
"The Red Bull,"
she said, accenting each of the two words.
"It was the Red Bull."
"The Red Bull? That made no sense at all." "What's going on here?" The voice came from the doorway. I spun round and found myself face to face with a nursing sister. It wasn't just the white uniform and stockings that made her seem so intimating. The blue cape with its red lining and piping had turned her into a human Union Jack.
Flavia?
The familiar voice took me by surprise. It was Flossie Foster, the sister of Feely's friend Sheila.
Flossie, is it really you?
I'd forgotten that Flossie had gone in for nursing. It was one of those trifles that had been mentioned at the dinner table by Feely, somewhere between the salad and the sausage rolls, and put out of mind before the plates were cleared away.
Of course it's me, you goose. What on earth are you doing here?
I came to visit a friend, I said, making a sweeping gesture toward Fenella.
But visiting hours aren't until this afternoon. If Matron catches you, she'll have your toes on toast.
Listen, Flossie, I said. I need a favour. I need a cigarette, and I need it quickly.
Ha, said Flossie. I should have known. Feely's little sister is a tobacco fiend.
It's not like that at all, I said.
Please, Flossie, I'll promise you anything.
Flossie reached into her pocket and pulled out a packet of De Mauriers and a monogrammed cloisonné lighter.
Now light it, I told her.
Surprisingly, she did as she was told, although a little furtively.
We only smoke in the nursing sister's tea room, she said, handing me the cigarette, and only when Matron's not around. It's not for me, I said, pointing to Fenella. Give it to her.
Flossie stared at me.
You must be mad, she said. Go ahead, give it to her, or I'll tell Matron what you had in the hip flask at the vicar's garden party.
I was only teasing, but before I could shoot her a grin, Flossie had inserted the cigarette between Fenella's dry lips.
You're a beast, she said, an absolutely horrid little beast.
I could tell she wanted to slap me as I gave her a triumphant smirk. But instead, we both of us broke off to look at Fenella. Her eyes were closed, and smoke was rising from her mouth in a series of puffs, like smoke signals from an Apache campfire. They might well have been spelling out the word B-L-I-S-S. It was at that very moment that Matron barged into the room. In her elaborate cocked hat and starched white bib, she looked like Napoleon, only much larger. She sized up the situation at a glance.
Nurse Foster, I'll see you in my office.
No, wait, I heard myself saying. I can explain.
Then do so.
The nurse just stepped in to tell us that smoking is forbidden. It's nothing to do with her.
Indeed.
I heard you coming, I said, and stuck my cigarette into that poor woman's mouth. It was stupid of me, I'm sorry. I snatched what was left of the cigarette from Fenella's lips and shoved it between my own. I took a deep drag and then exhaled, holding the thing between my second and third fingers in the continental manner, as I had seen Charles Boyer do in the cinema, and all the while fighting down the urge to choke.
"Then how do you explain this?"
Matron asked, picking up Flossie's lighter from Fenella's blanket and holding it out accusingly towards me.
"It's mine," I said. "The F is for Flavia, Flavia Deluce. That's me."
I thought I detected a nearly imperceptible squint, or was it more of a wince?
Of the Buckshaw Deluces?
Yes, I said. It was a gift from father. He believes that the occasional cigarette fortifies one's lungs against vapours from the drains. The matron didn't exactly gape, but she did stare at me as if I had suddenly sprouted a beak and tail feathers. Then suddenly, and without warning, she pressed the lighter into my hands and wiped her fingers on her skirt. There was the sound of professional shoe leather in the corridor, and Dr. Darby walked calmly into the room.
"Ah, Flavia," he said. "How nice to see you. This matron is the young lady whose prompt action saved the life of Mrs. Farr."
I stuck out a hand so quickly that the old dragon was forced to take it.
"Pleased to meet you, matron," I said. "I've heard so much about you."
Chapter 25. "But how is she?" I asked. "Fenella, I mean, really?"
"She'll do," said Dr. Darby.
We were motoring home to Bishop's Lacey, the Doctor's Morris humming happily along between the hedgerows like a sewing machine on holiday. "Fractured skull," he went on when I said nothing. "Depressed occipital condylar fracture, as we quacks call it. Has quite a ring to it, doesn't it? Thanks to you, we were able to get her into the operating room in time to elevate the broken bit without too much trouble. I think she'll likely make a full recovery, but we shall have to wait and see. Are you all right?" He hadn't missed the fact that I was sucking in great deep breaths of the morning air in an attempt to clear my system of cigarette smoke and the horrid odours of the hospital. The formalin of the morgue hadn't been too bad, quite enjoyable, in fact, but the reek of cabbage soup from the kitchen had been enough to gag a hyena. "I'm fine, thank you," I said, with what I'm afraid was rather a wan smile. "Your father will be very proud of you," he went on.
"Oh, please don't tell him. Promise you won't."
The doctor shot me a quizzical glance.
"It's just that he already has so much to worry about."
As I have said, Father's financial distress was no secret in Bishop's Lacey, particularly to his friends, of whom Dr. Darby was one. The vicar was the other. "I understand," the doctor said. "Then he shall not hear it from me. Still," he added with a chuckle, "the news is bound to get about, you know." I could think of nothing but to change the subject.
"I'm rather puzzled about something," I said. "The police took Fenella's granddaughter, poor Celine, to see her in the hospital. She claims Fenella told her it was me who bashed her on the head."
"And did you?" the doctor asked slyly.
"Later," I said, ignoring his teasing. "The vicar told me that he, too, had paid a visit, but that Fenella had not yet regained consciousness. Which of them was telling the truth?"
"The vicar is a dear man," Dr. Darby said. "A very dear man. He brings me flowers from his garden now and then to brighten up my surgery. But if cornered, I would have to admit that sometimes, on the wards, we are forced to tell him fibs. Little lies in little white jackets, for the good of the patient, of course. I'm sure you understand."
If there was one thing in the world that I understood above all others, it was withholding selected snippets of the truth.
It would not be an exaggeration to say that I was an exalted grand master of the craft. I nodded my head modestly. "He is very devoted to his work," I said. "As it happens, I was present when both the granddaughter and the vicar came to the hospital. Although the vicar didn't get as far as her room, Mrs. Farr was fully conscious at the time of his visit."
"And Porcelain?"
"At the time of Porcelain's visit, she was not. The victims of skull fracture, you see, can slip in and out of consciousness as easily as you and I move from one room to another, an interesting phenomenon when you come right down to it." But I was hardly listening.
"Porcelain had lied to me."
"The witch! There's nothing that a liar hates more than finding that another liar has lied to them."
"But why would she blame it on me?"
"The words must have slipped out. I had no intention of thinking aloud." "Ah," said Dr. Darby, "there are more things in heaven and earth, Horatio, than are dreamt of in your philosophy. Meaning that people can behave strangely in times of great stress. She's a complicated young woman, your friend Porcelain."
"She's no friend of mine," I said rather abruptly.
"You took her in and fed her," Dr. Darby said with an amused look. "Or perhaps I misunderstood." I felt sorry for her.
"Ah,
no more than sorry?"
"I wanted to like her."
"Aha. Why?"
The answer, of course, was that I was hoping to make a friend, but I could hardly admit that.
"We always want to love the recipients of our charity," the doctor said, negotiating a sharp bend in the road with a surprising demonstration of steering skill. "But it is not necessary. Indeed, it is sometimes not possible."
Suddenly I found myself wanting to confide in this gentleman, to tell him everything, but I could not.
The best thing for it, when you feel tears coming on for no reason at all, is to change the subject. Have you ever heard of the Red Bull?
The Red Bull? He asked, swerving to avoid a terrier that had dashed out barking into the road.
Which Red Bull did you have in mind?
Is there more than one?
There are many. The Red Bull at St. Elfrida's is the first that comes to mind. A smile crept over his face as if he was recalling a cosy evening of darts and a couple of pleasant pints of half and half.
And?
Well, let me see. There was the Red Bull on a green field from Kin, which was the god of 900 devils. The Red Bull of the Borgias, which was a flag and was on a field of gold, not green. The notorious Red Bull Playhouse that burned in the Great Fire of London in 1666. There was the mythical Red Bull of England that met the Black Bull of Scotland in a fight to the death. And, of course, in the days when priests practiced medicine, they used to hand out the hair of a Red Bull as a cure for epilepsy. Have I missed any?
Not one of these seemed likely to be the Red Bull that had attacked Fenella.
Why do you ask? He said, seeing my obvious puzzlement.
Oh, no reason, I said. It was just something I heard somewhere. The wireless, perhaps.
I could see that he didn't believe me, but he was gentleman enough not to press.
Here's St. Tancred's, I said. You can let me off at the churchyard.
Ah, said Dr. Darby, applying the Morris's brakes. Time for a spot of prayer?
Something like that, I said.
Actually, I needed to think. Thinking and prayer are much the same thing anyway, when you stop to think about it, if that makes any sense. Prayer goes up and thought comes down, or so it seems. As far as I can tell, that's the only difference. I thought about this as I walked across the fields to Buckshaw. Thinking about Brookie Harewood and who killed him, and why, was really just another way of praying for his soul. Wasn't it? If this was true, I had just established a direct link between Christian charity and criminal investigation. I could hardly wait to tell the vicar. A quarter mile ahead, and off to one side, was the narrow lane and the hedgerow where Porcelain had hidden in the bushes. Almost without realizing it, I found my feet taking me in that direction. If her claim about Fenella had been a lie, she couldn't really have been afraid of me, as she had pretended. There must, then, have been some other reason for her ducking into the hedgerow, one that I had not thought about at the time. If that was the case, she had successfully tricked me. I climbed over the stile and into the lane. It had been just about here that she'd slipped into the shrubbery. I stood for a moment in silence, listening.
Porcelain, I said, the hair at the back of my neck rising.
Whatever had made me think that she was still here.
Porcelain.
There was no answer. I took a deep breath, realizing it could easily be my last. With Porcelain, you could always so quickly find yourself with a knife at your throat. Another deep breath. This one for insurance purposes, and then I stepped into the hedgerow. I could see at once that there was nobody hidden here. A slightly flattened area and a couple of trampled weeds indicated clearly where Porcelain had squatted the other day. I crouched beneath the branches and wiggled myself into the same position that she must have assumed, putting myself in her shoes, looking out at the world as if from her eyes. As I did so, my hand touched something solid, something hard. It was shoved inside a little tent of weeds. I wrapped my fingers round the object and pulled it into view. It was black and circular, perhaps a little over 3 inches in diameter, and was made of some dark exotic wood, ebony perhaps. Carved into its circumference were the signs of the zodiac. I ran my forefinger slowly across the carved image of a pair of fish lying head to tail. Pisces. The last time I had seen this wooden ring was at the fete. It had been on the table in Fenella's tent, supporting her crystal ball.
There was little doubt that Porcelain had pinched the ball's base from the caravan and was making off with it when I had surprised her in the lane.
But why? Was it a souvenir?
Did it have some sentimental attachment?
Porcelain was simply infuriating. Nothing that she did made any sense.
Finding the base reminded me that the ball itself, hidden safely away in plain sight among my laboratory glassware, was still awaiting careful study. My intention had been to examine it for fingerprints, even though most traces had likely been washed away by immersion in the river. I remembered how Philip O'Dell, the wireless detective, had once pointed out to Inspector Hanley that the glandular secretions of the palms and fingers consisted primarily of water and water-soluble solids.
"So you see, Inspector," he had said, "Garvin's fatal mistake was in running his fingers through his hair. The barber had scented it with brilliantine, containing bay oil, which, of course, is soluble in alcohol, but not in water. Even after a night at the bottom of the millstream, the fingerprints on the handle of the knife were still plain enough to put his villainous neck in a noose."
Philip O'Dell aside, I had my own ideas about underwater fingerprints. There was, for instance, a quite readily available household substance that would fix and harden any traces of residual grime that might be left by a killer's hands. Given time, I would do the laboratory work, write it up, and present it to Inspector Hewitt on a silver platter. He would, of course, take my paper home at once and show it to his wife, Antigone. But there had been no time. The compulsory cinema night and choir practice at St. Tancred's, followed by my visit to Fenella in hospital, had robbed me of the opportunity to carry out the necessary research. I would hurry home and begin at once. I had no more than 1 foot out of the thicket when I heard the sound of an approaching motor. I ducked back into hiding, remembering to turn my face away as the thing swept past. By the time I judged it safe to come out again, the machine had vanished in the direction of Buckshaw. I did not actually spot the inspector's blue Vauxhall until I had already set foot between the griffins of the Mulford gates. It was parked off to one side beneath the chestnuts, and he was leaning patiently against it, waiting. Too late now to turn and bolt. I'd have to make the best of it.
"Oh, Inspector," I said. "I was just about to ring you up and tell you what I've found."
I was aware that I was gushing, but I didn't seem to be able to help myself. I held the wooden base out to him at arm's length.
"This was in a thicket by the side of the lane. I think it's part of Fenella's crystal ball."
He pulled a silk handkerchief from his breast pocket and took the wooden O from my hands.
"You shouldn't have touched it," he said. "You ought to have left it where it was."
"I realize that," I told him, "but it was too late. I touched it before I saw it, without meaning to. It was hidden under some weeds. I just stepped into the bushes for a moment."
The look on his face told me that I was skating on thin ice. I had already used the sudden call of nature excuse, and it wouldn't bear repeating.
"You saw me, of course, didn't you? That's why you stopped and waited for me here."
The inspector ignored this neat bit of deduction.
"Get in, please," he said, holding open the back door of the Vauxhall. "It's time for a talk."
Sergeant Graves turned round and shot me a quick, quizzical glance from the driver's seat, but he did not smile. Only then did I realize how much trouble I was in. We drove to the front door of Buckshaw in silence. It was my second full confession in as many days. We were sitting in the drawing room, all of us, that is, except Father, who was standing at the window staring out, as if his life depended on it, across the ornamental lake. He had insisted that we all of us be present, and had summoned Feely and Daffy, both of whom had annoyingly come at once, and were now seated primly side by side on a flowered divan like a couple of toads come to tea.
"It is regrettable," Inspector Hewitt was saying, "that our investigation has been so badly compromised.
crime scenes disturbed, evidence tampered with, crucial information withheld, I hardly know where to begin.
He was talking about me, of course.
I have tried to impress upon Flavia the seriousness of these matters, but with little success. Therefore, I'm afraid I'm going to insist, Colonel Deluce, that until such time as our work is complete, you keep her confined to Buckshaw.
I couldn't believe my ears. Confined to Buckshaw? Why not have me transported to Australia and be done with it?
Well, so much for choir duty and future cinema nights.
So much for Father's decree that we needed to get out more as a family.
Father mumbled something and shifted his gaze from the ornamental lake to the distant hills.
That said, the inspector went on, we come to the real reason for our being here.
Real reason?
My heart sank as if it already knew something that I did not. The inspector brought out his notebook.
A statement has been taken from a Miss Ursula Vipont, who says that she witnessed the removal from the river of what she described as...
He opened the notebook and flipped through a couple of pages.
A glass sphere.
My eyes widened.
By a child whose name she has reason to believe is Flavia Deluce.
Confound the woman! I knew at once that this busybody could be none other than that troll, Ursula, who haunted Vanetta Harewood's cottage in Malden Fenwick. I'd listed the odious creature in my notebook, but hadn't known her surname. She'd been standing hidden among the bushes at the Parlings, watching as I pulled Fenella's crystal ball from the river.
Well?
I could tell by his tone that the inspector was becoming impatient.
I was going to give it to you straight away, I said.
Where is it? He asked.
In my laboratory. I'll go get it and...
No. Stay as you are. Sergeant Graves will see to it.
Surprised, the sergeant broke off gazing at Feely and leapt to his feet.
Just a moment, sergeant, she said. I'll show you the way. The traitor, the minx, even with her little sister under attack, Ophelia could think of nothing but courtship. Wait, I said. The laboratory is locked. I'll have to go fetch the key.
Before anyone could think to stop me, I had swept past Feely and the sergeant out the door and was halfway down the hall. The truth was that the key was in my pocket, but without turning me upside down and shaking me, they had no way of knowing that. Up the stairs I dashed, taking them two at a time, as if all the demons of Hades were at my heels. Into the east wing I fled, and down the long corridor. I fumbled at the lock of the laboratory, but something inside the mechanism seemed to be mucked up, as if... I gave a fierce shove, and the door flew open, propelling me almost into the arms of Porcelain.
Chapter 26.
What are you doing here?
I hissed, my heart still pounding like a trip hammer.
I thought you were in London.
I might have been, Porcelain said, but something made me come back to apologize.
You did that once before, I said, and you botched it. I can live without another of your so-called apologies.
I know, she said, and I'm sorry. I didn't tell you the truth about Fenella. She wasn't conscious when I went to the hospital, and she didn't tell me you'd attacked her. I made it all up because I wanted to hurt you.
But why?
I don't know. I wish I did, but I don't. Suddenly,